It's Monday night.
I've been in the game a long time. When a catcher catches the ball and it's strike three, you call the guy out. It's that simple, isn't it?
And if it's Monday, it's the knee jerks.
I'm not going to sit here and rip umpires, but you saw what you saw, clearly saw what you saw. I just saw it for the 10th time. Write it and say something once in a while. Have the nerve to say something.
Detroit Sports Talk with Attitude.
Attitude on this! 1, 2, 3!
Attitude!
Coming up tonight, will Big Al guess whose birthday it is? Who are the jerks of the week? What will Eno rant about now? The answers coming up next. Two guys who know Detroit sports, the voice of reason, Greg Eno and Big Al Beaton.
It's Independence Day weekend, and we're talking to you on Sunday, July 5th, 2015. That also means it's time for the Knee Jerks, Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al. I'm the Big Al of the equation, Al Beaton, longtime Detroit podcaster and blogger. Joining me, as always, is, well, I hear he's now added the name Landscaper to everything else he does, and that would be Greg Eno of GregEno.com and About.com. Greg, how's things?
Amateur, as I am in everything else. I am doing fine. Al Beaton, thank you so much for the intro. I am Greg Eno from GregEno.com. That's where you can read me every day of the week. You can also check me out at About.com, my Detroit Tigers stuff, at DetroitTigers.About.com, as we take you through the Tigers season twice a week there. And also follow me on Twitter, at Greg Eno. Follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter, at the Knee Jerks. Our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/the Knee Jerks. And our blog is thekneejerks.us. A couple of programming notes. First of all, it's good to be back with you because we've been off since June 14th. But a couple of programming notes. August the 2nd, we've officially booked Oakland University basketball coach Greg Campy. Looking forward to that immensely, talking to Coach Campy about his program and all the wins he's mustered at that, you know, within that same program. It's kind of an unusual situation for somebody to stay at that mid-level for that long to win that many basketball games. So we're going to talk to Coach Campy. I'm sure we'll talk about the season upcoming, what he's got cooking in terms of recruits and incoming freshmen and what his roster looks like for the 15-16 season. We'll do that on Sunday, August the 2nd. Our next show with you will be with Al and me on July the 19th, 2 weeks from today. So that's what we're going to be doing, the 19th and August the 2nd. So that's what I wanted to get out of the way. Al's got, we're going to kind of blow through this in about an hour, hour and 15 minutes today. We got several topics, but a couple of them are going to probably take up most of the time. I'm sure the Miguel Cabrera situation and the Red Wings free agency situation, the Pistons draft and their free agency situation, we'll kind of use those as our main courses today. But before we do any of that, let's play a game we like to call Whose Birthday Is It, Maestro?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Saturday Job. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Saturday Job. Happy birthday to you.
Everybody knows how we play this game by now. I give Al a clue or two or three of an individual whose birthday it is today in the world of sports. And if Al correctly guesses that person within the first two clues, he will win, quite simply, a Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, that'll keep me occupied for a couple years.
I never tried one of those. I don't know if you did.
We had a couple laying around the house when I was a kid, but it was more for my sisters. I got better things to do with my time. But I'm old and have more time on my hands now. So
this person, Al, made his first. He was born today in 1950, so he's 65 years old today. He made his name in baseball. He was the 1973 National League Rookie of the Year, which I didn't know until I looked that up. And he ended up playing for the, I would say, tell you, he would play for the Giants, when he was the Rookie of the Year. But then he went on to play for four other teams, three of which were in the National League, and he ended up being the NLCS MVP in one of those years in the 1980s. And he was an All-Star in 1979, and he hit 234 home runs. So that's kind of a lot for a first
year. Yeah, that's quite a bit. But, you know, geez, 73 Rookie of the Year. My God, I was all of like 11. 12 then, so that's it. We want to keep this show moving, so I will. No, I know it's not Bobby Bonds, so I think it's up before that time, so I'm gonna pass on this one, and I'll wait for more clues.
Okay.
All right, let's rock and roll. Are you ready to get this show started?
Let's do it.
All right, let's start with the Tigers, because well, they've been a source of one, much drama within the fan base of the team. Also because, well, we don't know where this team is headed right now, because they've been hovering around 500. They've been hovering about 5-6 games back at first place over the past few weeks in the Central. And they received a crushing blow on Friday, and that would be the loss of Miguel Cabrera. It was really a nothing play. He was taken off on the pitch, going from first to second, pulled up lame. And when Miguel Cabrera can't play and actually leaves the field immediately, you know it's serious, because Miguel Cabrera, well, look what he's played through in the past, a torn groin and a broken foot. And this injury, which turned out to be a grade 3 strain of his right calf, is sending him to the disabled list for the first time in his career, which really says something about his toughness and how much the Tigers depended on him, because they really don't have a true backup on the roster right now, let alone Cabrera was having another all-star MVP-type season, hitting .350, getting on base at a .456 clip, and slugging .578. That's an OPS of 1.034, which is, you know, Hall of Fame territory, as we come to expect from Cabrera. So, Greg, right now, Cabrera is expected to miss 6 weeks. They really don't have a backup per se. Right now, it looks like Alex Avila may be shifting over to play quite a bit of first base right now. Because since they do have the very capable James McCann, who can handle the catching duties. But with the Tigers' struggles as of late and their inconsistencies on offense, and this is the equivalent of any, you know, when you lose the best player, I'll put it this way, when you lose one of the best players in baseball, it's going to affect you greatly. The question is, do the Tigers have enough offense to remain in contention without one of the best hitters of his generation? And so far it's gone well, but we've seen this a lot though, Greg, where teams will lose a player, and for the first week or so, they play very well, but it's going to catch up with them, isn't it?
Oh yeah, over the course of over the course of an extended period of time, which they're saying 6 weeks, but that's probably a best case scenario, because you got to figure that even if he's ready to go in 6 weeks, you've got to do a rehab stint. You have to, you know, it's going to take some time to get the timing back. I mean, you're probably looking more like after September 1. I would guess it would be probably a more accurate assessment, unless he really heals a lot quicker than folks think. But no, you're right about sustainability. I mean, you can muddle along for a little while and short spurts and maybe keep your head above water. But, you know, all you have to do, Al, is just look at the Tigers' offense when Victor Martinez was out.
Yeah.
Now, with all due respect to Victor, he's not Miguel Cabrera. He's still a very good hitter, obviously. But you could see when Victor was out how the offense really scuffled and how they really missed his presence. And then when he came back, I mean, it got a little better for sure. You could see the effect that his return had. And now he was back, but he was back healthier, and he was more like his old self, which he wasn't, of course, before he went on the disabled list. So when he wasn't, you know, even when he was in the lineup and not producing, and then certainly when he was out of the lineup completely, the Tigers' offense really, really scuffled. So you can't tell me that you're going to minus Miguel Cabrera and then everything's going to be hunky-dory. I mean, now you can have, you know, you can say all you want about, well, certain guys need to step it up and increase their production. And first of all, that's easier said than done. Secondly, it's just, you know, you're just going to have to start winning games, Al, with lower scoring scores. I mean, you're going to have to start winning games 3-2, 4-3. And that's why I think what's not being talked about here as much is it's not so much the Tigers' offense that's going to suffer, which it is, but from a win-loss perspective, if the pitching doesn't get better, then they have no chance. They have no chance at all. You cannot be giving up lots of runs anymore because you're missing such a key cog in the middle of your lineup. So they really need to get that bullpen and that starting pitching to kind of mesh and click. If that doesn't happen and they're forced to go out there and try to score 5 or 6 runs a game, they may finish below 500 this year.
Yeah, and that brings up the fact that since we last talked, the Tigers have made a ton of moves in the pitching staff. First off, Shane Green is in Toledo, as he actually fell off a cliff. He looked like a world beater in his first 3 starts, and then I think every start after that, he ended up his ERA was like over 8 or something ridiculous like that. So the Tigers have been kind of scrambling to find a fifth starter. They also recently just made the designated for assignment Tom Borzolani and Jabba Chamberlain. So they are both gone, calling up a couple of no names. I don't even have their names handy at the moment. You were right. The pitching staff has really been in flux, and the only dependable starter has been David Price, and the only dependable reliever has been Joaquin Soria. So, and for example, Justin Verlander is back in his back. He missed a turn recently, again, because of a sore back. He's pitching as we are recording right now. But Verlander obviously looks like a guy who's missed most of the season. And yes, he's pitching, but he still doesn't look like he's all there. I think he's going to end up being better than he is right now just because it's still, in a lot of ways, training camp for him. But I'm really concerned. Even more so than a bullpen, I'm really concerned about the starting pitching, because this starting pitching we were spoiled the last few years with that staff, and all of a sudden what's gone from one of the best staffs in baseball to David Price and 4 question marks.
Yeah, David Price and pray for rain. But,
yes.
You know, the thing is, Al, is that they still have a chance to have the makings of a decent rotation.
Yes.
Adolfo Sanchez is pitching better as of late.
He took a no-hitter in, the 8th inning in his last start?
Took a no-hitter in the 8th inning. I mean, he's still giving up too many home runs, but he's starting to come around. If you look at his last maybe 6-7 starts, the numbers are a lot better than they were in the previous 3 or 4 starts. He's starting to kind of settle down a little bit into more of the Adolfo Sanchez that we knew. Alfredo Simon, I think, is still doing better than I think a lot of people thought he would do. He's had a couple of bumps in the road, but I think for the most part, he's been pretty consistent. If you combine Price, an improved Sanchez, a continuing to be consistent Simon, and if Verlander can be, you know, maybe even a...
If he becomes a number 2 or 3 starter, he's no longer an ace, but if he can be a number 2 or 3, that's great.
Yeah. No, of course not. But all of a sudden now you've got Price, you got Sanchez, who's got a track record, who seems to be getting his act together. You got Simon, who seems to be, so far holding his own. You've got, Verlander, who we hope that he can use somebody like Kyle to kind of get himself back up to self. I know there's a lot of ifs there, but it's not like these guys are 4 no names who've never done anything before in the big leagues. So there's a chance that they could, get themselves together and give you at least four decent starters, and then of course Kyle Ryan, which, you don't expect a lot from him. He's a rookie, and he's number 5 for a reason. But he's lefty, and that's a nice thing to have. They have 2 lefties in the rotation. But you're right. I mean, you should be worried, though, having said all that, because there has been, definitely some leaks in the rotation. Let's face it, there's been some real nasty stuff going on there. Shane Green, you illustrated, was so bad that he got himself sent to the minors. That was disappointing after because everybody, when they acquired Green, there was a lot of optimism about his stuff, about his arm.
Right.
Of course, he's young. And then he came out of the gate, like Nolan Ryan. And so you figure, well, this is a steal for the Tigers. And then he just, like you said, fall off a cliff. And that's not to say he can't still come back and be productive, but, he's a big question mark now.
Right.
And so, there has been a lot of stuff going on with the rotation. There's no question about it. And so it's been... when the rotation was, you know, the bullpen was started off okay, and now they've definitely started to burst at the seams a little bit. So it's all about pitching now. You know, the Tigers are still, especially with Cabrera gone now, you just can't go out there and win, try to win game 7-6, 6-5. They're going to have to figure out ways to win lower scoring games, and that puts a lot of pressure on that staff to keep the damage to a minimum, because, you know, say what you will about J.D. Martinez and Victor and so forth, Cespedes, but that's just a gaping. I know teams play through injuries all the time. I get it, but that's a big one. I mean, that's a big one.
Yeah, and you're right. Normally you would think, oh, yeah, David Price, Anibal Sanchez, Justin Verlander. That's not so hot. That's not so bad. But you're like, but yeah, through the first half, it's really been David Price. And even though you're right, Sanchez is showing signs of coming out of his funk. And realistically, though, as you said, if Sanchez and Verlander can be a semblance of their normal selves, the starting pitching should be okay. But the bullpen has always been a question for the last several years, Greg. And with Gorslani and Chamberlain being DFA'd, do you think this is a sign that Dave Dombrowski is finally showing? It's kind of a way of showing some urgency here that we're almost halfway through the season. We're essentially been playing mediocre baseball, and we have to start shaking things up because what we have isn't going to get us in the playoffs.
You know, your hand is forced where you just have to make a change. Now, I'm sure he's not thrilled about Drew Verhaeven and this Farrell kid coming up, and I'm sure the expectations for these kids are very low, but that's how bad it had gotten with Java and with Gorzolani. Gorzolani especially, you know, if you're a left-hander, Al, in the big leagues and you can't get lefties out, you're absolutely no use. You have no use whatsoever. Gorzolani was a veteran guy. They thought was gonna, you know, give them that kind of, you know, replace Phil Koch.
Yeah.
Do the things for them that Phil Koch was unable to really do on a consistent basis, and it just didn't work out. He just never really got into a rhythm. He, you know, had a couple of decent outings, but he didn't really, and especially as of late, his performance has been very suspect. And Jabba, you know, obviously the 3 home run debacle against the Pirates was the final nail in the coffin there. You know, and so Dave Dombrowski, let's face it, Drew Verhaeven and the Cyril kid were down there. You're always in the minors for a reason. You know, these were not two guys that the Tigers were so high on that they couldn't wait to get them to the big leagues, and they're just looking for a reason to do
so. Yeah, Farrell was like a 25th or 26th round pick who has had like one game at AAA. So
yeah, this is now one of those things where we just can't wait to get this kid to the big leagues. We can't wait to, you know, let's fast track him. Let's get him through the system real fast. No, this was a case of we've got two veterans that are just not getting the job done. We're gonna they're performing so poorly that we're willing to just completely release them and try these two kids in the minors. I mean, that's what this is all about. It's not about, oh, I can't, there's finally an opportunity to bring these kids up and see what they can do. No. Mm-hmm. If Dave Dombrowski had his druthers, those kids would be still in Erie and Toledo, respectively, and that's where they'd stay all year except for maybe after September 1.
Yeah.
Other than that, that would be their total contribution to the organization. Now, his hand has been forced. You almost had to get rid of Jabba and Gorzolani because they were contributing nothing. I mean, they were just, you know, adding fuel to whatever fire they were being brought in to put out. They had to go. And, you know, that was, but now, again, we talked about this before, that the Tigers are still not in a situation now, I don't care, even with the loss of Cabrera, they're still not in a situation where you can comfortably say, well, they're totally out of it because there's still a couple of games within the wild card. You still got some star players. You still got a team that's won the division 4 years in a row. You still got an owner who is not going to pack it in that easily. So they're still not in a sell situation. They still maintain that they're going to be in a mode come July 31st, which is creeping up. They'll be in a mode of looking to add some pieces, whether it's bullpen arms or whether it's another hitter, whether it's a first baseman. You know, you know, this talk about Ben Zobrist has been mentioned. I mean, what are they going to – they're still going to be in that mode. Unless they just go in the tank and lose 10 out of the next 11 games and really fall out of the mix. If they're within 3, 4, 5 games of that wild card, Al, that play-in game, which, you know, scares you if you're a divisional leader, but doesn't scare you if you're scraping on the outside looking in because you're just trying to get yourself into October baseball any way you can, well, then they're going to make some moves. I mean, now the problem with this, it's one thing to just say, well, they'll make some moves. They don't have a lot of chips, Al, with which to play. There's not, you know, a lot of these chips, bargaining chips that they've used in the past several years have been used in the past several years, so they don't have a lot going on right now. There's not a lot of talent in the minor leagues of the Tigers that would return big league players that would maybe be difference makers. That's the problem. It may just be change for change sake. You may have to trade somebody off the 25-man roster, frankly, to get what you want. You may have to trade, the problem is guys like Cespedes, who's in the last year of his contract, you're not going to get what you'd like to get for him because he's in the last year of his contract.
Right.
So teams are not, he'd be a rental. And you're not going to get a lot for a rental. You're going to get in a rental situation. You're going to be the one that's getting the prospects. You're not going to be the one that's going to now. You're in a sell mode if you do that. But you may have to trade somebody out off the 25 man to try to get somebody who could be a big league player who could create some sort of an impact. Other than that, I don't know that they've got a lot down there in the minors. Unless they start trading the real young kid, like the kid that just drafted, to a team that's. But again, you've got it. In that case, you're probably dealing with a team that's totally out of it.
Yeah.
And when you start to limit yourself to the teams that are totally out of it, that becomes that. Now you're just talking about a handful of teams, and they may not have the players that you want, to succeed. And it's all about what do you do, for the future. What the Tigers are. Crossroads right now. What path do you take? Do you go for it? Do you maybe start to kind of realize that maybe this is not sustainable and this could really go off the deep end in a year or two? What path do you take? I suspect that knowing Dombrowski, knowing Mike Ilitch, and knowing the fact they've won 4 divisions in a row, that they're not going to go lightly, gently into the night.
Right.
They're not just going to say, we'll see it next year. We'll see it 3 years from now. I don't think they're going to do that. I think they're going to still try to make another run because I agree with that. By the way, I think as long as you've got a chance to get yourself into October baseball, you do it because you don't know how much longer you have to. This opportunity may not exist next year. What I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So you've got to. And because they may not have Price next year. They may not have Cespedes next year. You have to, if you think you've got a chance to be playing in October, even if it's just that play-in game, I think you do it.
Yeah. Yeah, you pretty much have to. You can't be sellers when you're only a couple games out of the wild card, which they are right now, which they will likely remain, even without Miguel Cabrera. And you make a great point with Mike Ilitch. No, he's pushing 90 years old. He wants a World Series. He's not going to start a rebuilding project when he's that age and as big of a payroll as this team has. And you also make a great point that you're going to get pennies on the dollar if you decide to trade Cespedes, David Price, guys like that. As you said, last year of contract, the rentals, you no guarantee you're going to be able to keep them. You aren't going to get a haul for those guys, despite what fans think is going to happen. That's the one that always gets me. Oh, let's be sellers. We'll get a boatload of young players. No, you won't. Not when they're rentals. The time to trade those guys is essentially when the Tigers got David Price, when you still have them under contract for a year.
Right.
That's when you're able to get guys as Tampa did with Drew Smiley. So
you're going to get low to mid level prospects. You may even get like players to be named later. Those kinds of trades. You're not going to get an Addison Russell type guy or the other kid for the Cubs. Who's the kid they call it? Brian. You're not going to get guys like that. You're going to get mid to low level prospects who are going to be sent immediately to Class A or Class AA, and who knows, we'll ever see them at the big league level. This is what it's going to be. Now, if you let these guys, if you don't trade them, by the way, if you let them go to free agency, at least you can get a first-round draft choice from
get
the team that signs
them. Yeah, exactly.
Which is probably a better return then would be to give it some mid to low level prospects and then essentially raise the white flag on the season.
Yeah, exactly. So, and what's the most frustrating part of this team is, Greg, is that there are several players having all-star quality years. I mean, J.D. Martinez has become an absolute scary threat at the plate. He's second in the league in home runs at 22, and he looks like the next coming of Victor Martinez and Miguel Cabrera. Martinez has finally come around after the injury. He's starting to play hit like Victor Martinez can hit. But Jose Iglesias is playing like one of the best shortstops in the game. He's going to be an all-star. David Price has put up all-star numbers. Cespedes has put up all-star numbers. James McCann has had a very, very good season for a rookie. But for some reason, this team just isn't meshing. You know, and there's been some major disappointments, too. Anthony Goes, who the Tigers gave up one of their top prospects for, and Travis, is showing why the Blue Jays gave up on him. And I think the biggest disappointment would be Nick Castellanos, who has struggled mightily. Now, when you have a .281 on base percentage this late in the year, everybody was expecting him to take at least another small step forward. He had a pretty solid rookie year. This year, he has looked completely lost at the plate, and it's really hurt the Tigers lower in the order.
You know, Castellanos has been, that's a tough one. That's a tough call because, you know, you hate to give up on somebody. He's only 24 years old, I believe, 23, 24. He had, like you said, he had a decent, you know, I think as far as the whole body of work it goes, I think for a rookie third baseman, he acquitted himself well. He played on a divisional winning team that he did not have to rely on the third baseman to be an all-star. Anyway, I thought he held his own. You know, I thought he completely acquitted himself in a manner that was acceptable, totally acceptable. I had no problems with his rookie year whatsoever. And so then you kind of felt like, okay, you know, he can build on that. Tigers don't have to worry about third base for a long time. Mm. He's under team control for a number of years. You don't have to worry about that. He's cheap. You know, it's fine. And let's worry about other things. Well, you know, as you said, the second year has been obviously much worse than the first, no question about that. And these things happen. I mean, you know, the rookies, sometimes the pitchers figure them out. It's all about adjustment, you know. Can the young player adjust to what the pitchers are doing, you know, making adjustments against him? And, you know, he's looked not good. There's no question about these. Defensively, he was never great to begin with. He's still not great. I mean, he's okay. He's serviceable. He does have a lot of range. But again, with Iglesias playing next to him, you don't have to have, you know, you can basically have the range of a pylon. And Iglesias will pretty much scoop up everything that's hit to the left side of the infield. So that's okay. You know, but he's not going to win any gold gloves. We knew that anyway. But he's not, you mentioned the .281 on base. You can't. For a big league third baseman, and he ranks, by the way, as one of the worst big league third basemen. If you look at some of the advanced metrics go, I mean, he does not rank very well when you start to really break the numbers down. So that's a concern. You're right. I'm not too concerned yet about him. I mean, he's got an incredible range. I think he's already made me forget about Austin Jackson as far as defensively goes. I think he's completely, you know, I'm fine with him defensively. You know, I mean, there's no question about that. But, you know, you talk about all these guys, Al, that are having, you indicated, having solid years, and you're right. You wonder, okay, well, why is this team 41-39 as we record this when they've got all these guys that are having these kinds of years? And I think it's just a matter of they have not been able to mesh the offense with the pitching. They pitch well, they don't hit. They hit well, they don't pitch. And that's why they're .500. They can't get that. They haven't gone on one of those 10 out of 12 streaks because they've not been able to have everything firing on all cylinders at the same time. That's what it is. You know, these guys are good numbers, yes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's when do you get the numbers? When are you compiling them? You know, and J.D. Martinez, though, I mean, he just keeps hitting one big home run after the other. His home runs, Al, aren't just, you know, padding his statistics. He's hitting home runs, and he was doing this last year, too. Yep. He hits them in big situations, big-time situations. He's hitting them in the eighth inning, the ninth inning, seventh inning, when the score, you know, to change the lead or to give the Tigers a lead or to tie a game, or, you know, these home runs are not just you know, empty home runs for a statistic. These are big-time clutch home runs. He's got this knack, Al, of hitting these things when they are really important. Yeah. And that's a knack. You can't teach that, obviously. Either you have that or you don't. But this kid is as cool as a cucumber when it comes to these late-inning, high-leverage situations. I mean, you mentioned it. He is a major threat. I think he gets more dangerous the later you go in the game. He hasn't hit on home runs in the first four or five innings of any game. He has his home runs from the sixth inning on. And at least that's what it seems like. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but most of his home runs come sixth inning on, and those are big-time home runs.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess we'll wrap this up discussion by, I guess, saying that, one, Justin Verlander is now getting rocked. He's down 6-0 in the fifth inning today. But again, I think the jury's still out on him. It's realistically still like his spring training. And it's really, when it comes to Verlander, it's what he does in the second half at this point, because right now I think he's still rounded into shape. But regardless of all that, they're not going. I think we're both in agreement. They're not going to be sellers. This is a team that's going to make some sort of move at the trade deadline. Remains to be seen if they have enough ammunition to get anything that can seriously help them. Because right now, you made a great point. There's nothing left, realistically, at the lower levels to make a deal. And it's now 7-0. Verlander just gave up another home run. All right. Well, with that, let's wrap it up because not wrap up the podcast, but wrap up the Tigers conversation, as I'm sure we'll have more to talk about them in the next 2 weeks when the trade deadline begins to loom. That's still about a month away. So, Greg, I think it's the time to bring up question two of the birthday game.
Sure. As I indicated, the first clue, this individual was the National League Rookie of the Year in 1973, playing for the San Francisco Giants. He was pretty much a National Leaguer his entire career, with the exception of one final year with the Seattle Mariners, which was very forgettable. But he did play on some big-time teams. He was the MVP of the 1983 NLCS. I'll leave you to figure out who that team was that he played for. And he was a member of a team that participated in the 1984 NLCS as well. And he was a outfielder, obviously, and his nickname was Sarge.
Yep. That gives it away right there. I was pretty sure what it was. But when you say the nickname Sarge, it has to be Gary Matthews, correct?
Yes, that's Gary Matthews. Yeah, I should have maybe held off on the Sarge thing.
Yeah.
But that's okay. I really wanted you to have a Rubik's Cube. So.
Thank you.
Sarge Matthews, 83 NLCS MVP for the Phillies, and 84 he played for the Cubs team that won the National League East, and played a number of years for the Braves, Giants, and finished up, like I said, 1 year with the Mariners in 1987 at age 37. So Gary Matthews, of course, his son. I was also getting another clue. Was his son, who has the same name, was a big leaguer as well, Gary Matthews Jr., who was a pretty good player by himself. That's the answer, and you are getting a Rubik's Cube.
Oh, thank you. All right. Speaking of Rubik's Cubes, I think the off seasons for the Red Wings and Pistons have been kind of like that. They're trying to make moves to get all the colors correct, so to speak. And we'll start talking about the Red Wings offseason as free agency for both leagues, NHL and NBA, began earnest this week. And the Red Wings, for the first time in a few seasons, made a free agency splash. Ken Holland got a lot of criticism for coming up empty the last few offseasons in free agency, really just kind of getting the leftover, so to speak, such as Steven Weiss, who we'll talk about shortly. But this year was a little bit different. Ken Holland struck early on the first day of free agency, filling two big roster holes. The first was signing 29-year-old Washington Capitals right-hand shooting, which is a big deal for the Red Wings, defenseman Mike Green to a 3-year, $18 million contract. Green is good as a top-four defenseman and is likely to be paired with the since he's an offensive-oriented defenseman, he'll likely be paired with the defensive-oriented Danny DeKeyser, which really seems like a good matchup. I think that's a very, very good signing for a team that really needs offense from the blue line, especially when their top offensive defenseman is aging in Cronwall. So, and then the second deal, with the Wings needing depth at center, specifically because Pavel Datsyuk may miss the first few weeks of the regular season due to having ankle surgery this week. They signed veteran center Brad Richards, 35 years old, spent the last year with the Stanley Cup winning Blackhawks. It's an incentive-laden one-year deal worth $3 million, but could be worth up to $4 million if the Wings win a certain amount of games. So, Greg, where do you fall on these? These look like solid signings in free agency. Players who, you know, aren't really, they aren't all-stars per se. Well, Green has all-star kind of talent. But they're guys who have been very productive, have remained very productive, and most importantly, they fill needs of depth on the Red Wings that, for the most part, well, they badly needed a defenseman who could shoot, and they badly needed a center. And Colin, I think, gets a – I'd give him like a B-plus on these signings.
I think, you know what, to get a guy like Mike Green, who's still only 29, he's mm-hmm. in the prime of his career – you know, 3 years. I'm kind of surprised that the contract was only 3 years. I'm surprised his agent wasn't able to get maybe 4 or 5 years out of somebody because he is only 29 years old. I was a little bit surprised at that, but hey, I'm not complaining. You know, $6 million, I think, at this juncture in this day and age is reasonable for a guy that that skill level.
Yeah, top four defenseman. Yeah, that seems like reasonable money. That's market.
Top four defenseman, a guy that can quarterback a power play. He's, you know, he's got some deficiencies in his own zone, but he's, you know, the Red Wings, I think, can make up for that with the other defensemen they have. They really needed, you know, Nick Cromwell wasn't getting any younger. They needed another guy that can really quarterback a power play. You know, Nick Lidstrom's long gone, obviously. So somebody like Green, I think, was a good add. Richards, you know, I mean, 35, I get it, but he's won a couple of Stanley Cups. He's, you know, he's, I was talking to Matt Hutter, our NHL Red Wings insider, about this on Facebook the other day, and Matt said, hey, Brad Richards, you know, in his prime was one of the best two-way centers in the NHL, and right. He's still got, Matt thinks he still has something to contribute. Again, that was a smart contract.
Yeah, you can do a lot worse on a one-year stopgap, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, $3 million for 1 year. You've got to, you know, you don't know exactly when Pavel Datsyuk is going to be healthy. He's going to have surgery on his ankle. You don't know when he's going to really be back. They say, you know, he might miss, certainly will miss training camp, but you don't know how much of the regular season will miss. So it's good to have, you know, a stopgap measure there. And then you've got the fact that they bought out Stephen Weiss. So, you know, that takes Stephen Weiss out of the equation. He wasn't going to be apparently the number two or number three center that they hoped. So you rid yourself of Weiss, and now you bring in Richards, and a guy that who's unlike Stephen Weiss, has played in a lot of playoff games. He's won, you know, like I said, won a couple of Stanley Cups most recently, you know, just mm-hmm. last month with the Blackhawks. So I have no problems with either of these signings. I think they address needs. I don't think that they're just, you know, done for the sake of signing somebody. I don't get that feeling at all. And the thing I really like about it now is it kind of, and it should make Red Wings fans feel a lot better that, like you said, after striking out a couple times with some major, right. You know, major attempts, Holland is reeled a couple guys in now, and to hear both of these players talk, it's about, once again, it's about the organization, it's about the culture, it's about the same things that players always have talked about when they come to the Red Wings. So despite the fact that the Red Wings have not been past the second round of the playoffs in 6 years, there's still obviously some sort of an aura, a mystique about this club, because you've got these guys that are signing here who have said they did so because of what this is all about here in Detroit. So that's a good sign, because you've got a new coach, you've got you've got some misses in the playoffs recently, you've got some misses in free agency lately. So I think this is a good confidence booster for the organization too, that they're good enough to attract players of this magnitude who can, these are I wouldn't say Richards, but Green is an A-lister mm-hmm. as far as the free agency goes, and he was one of the top, he was one of those guys that you didn't really think the Red Wings would really have a chance to sign.
Welcome back inside.
But lo and behold, here we are.
It's so great to have Greg Kelcer here joining us with his insight there. And his camp.
There we go. Okay. It's, I really don't have really much more to add to that, because, you know, how this is the Holland is being Holland, and he found guys that can play. And speaking of that, a guy who, well, this is one of his, probably one of his worst free agent signings. Well, looks like Holland admitted a mistake by buying out the remaining 3 years of Stephen Weiss's contract. This one was a real, I think, a real stinker of a signing because of the background of this, Greg, is because the Wings a couple years ago allowed Vitaly Flipola to walk in free agency and then to replace him for essentially the same money. It was a 5-year, $24.5 million deal. They picked up Weiss. And that since that time, Flipola has become a very vital piece of the Lightning, who played for the Stanley Cup this year, while Weiss was spent long periods of time as a healthy scratch and ultimately put up 29 points over, I believe, two seasons. So not only opening up cap room, this really looks like the Wings, this gives the Wings a way to give an opening, a foot in the door, say, okay, here's your opportunity to 2014 first-round draft pick Dylan Larkin, who reportedly has done nothing but impress the Red Wings brass so far.
Well, you know, we already know what the feeling apparently in the organization is about Anthony Mantha.
Yes.
That there's some disappointment about him. But you're right about Larkin. They're very high on him. The Weiss thing, Al, is it's tough to just outright say, well, that was a stinker. Because at the time, it looked like it was a good deal. Okay, you know, he put up some numbers. He never really was a playoff guy because his team never made the playoffs. So you can't hold that against him. But he'd only played in one playoff series before the Red Wings acquired him. But, you know, I'm talking to Bob Page, who watches a lot of hockey down there in Florida. Mm-hmm. He thought Weiss was a good signing. He was a good player. And he came to Detroit. He had that groin injury hernia, whatever he had, right from the get-go. And you pretty much give him a pass for the first year. Okay, that's fine. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly the second year, when he got healthier and he was playing a little more regularly, fell out of favor with Mike Babcock, which you don't want to do that, and because it's hard to get back into favor. But, to Babcock's credit, he started Weiss in the first two games of the playoffs against Tampa, and nothing happened, absolutely no impact whatsoever, none at all, a bunch of zeros next to his line on the score sheet. So, you take him out of the lineup and you try somebody else. And I remember writing at the time that, after those first two games were pretty much he was invisible, I said, Stephen Weiss is running out of mulligans. I mean, you can give him a pass about the injury. You can say, okay, you say what you're, give him the benefit of the doubt because he's a veteran and so forth, and you spend all this money and so forth. But comes a time where you've got to start to produce. And I said, he's not doing anything. I'd be surprised if Mike Babcock doesn't make a change. Well, of course he did. I didn't think it would necessarily lead to a buyout ultimately. But, sometimes these things happen. It's like the Uli Krupp signing, Gary Hatcher. Injuries sometimes just, you can't predict them. You can't really, hold the GM's feet to the fire on those kind of things because that's totally hindsight. Hindsight is 20/20. I mean, obviously now the Weiss signing was horrible. I mean, obviously. There's no question about it. But at the time, it wasn't like, I don't remember hearing a lot of Red Wings fans, gnashing their teeth and wringing their hands. Thinking,
it was kind of a coin flip. 6-1, half dozen of the other between the two players for the most part.
You let a guy go because maybe he needs to go. And you bring another guy who comes from another organization. Sometimes those things work. You look at the two players and say, well, 6-1, half dozen the other, okay, fine, but maybe it's good for both players to get out of their respective locations, try something new, let Flipola go to Tampa, do his thing, bring Weiss in. Hopefully he steps up his game and takes it to another level. And obviously that didn't happen. But to Ken Holland's credit, he didn't. He cut his losses. I think that he could have brought Stephen Weiss back and hoped that he was given one more shot at it. But, I think this is, again, we talked about this before. This is the mentality now, Al.
Right.
We talked about Mantha. We talked about the comments about Mantha. Now the Weiss thing. The Red Wings are now continue to display this urgency and this lack of patience that I think is appropriate. You know, they've not been to the Stanley Cup Finals in 6 years. They've never been close to the Stanley Cup Finals in 6 years. So now it's time to say, okay, look, you know, pop a shut up. And you know, you could have brought Steven Weiss back for a third year and say, okay, you know what? He had a bad first year because of injuries. You know, he can have a good second year. Let's have this year be the year that really determines which Steven Weiss we're going to get. They could have done that, and I think that probably would have. You could have sold that. I think you could have sold that to the fan base. But you know, to their credit, they said, you know what? No, enough. We need to. You know, the guy like Richards comes in. You know, he's a winner. He's got some playoff mileage on him. He's, you know, I know he's 35, mm-hmm. but you know he's been able to stay healthy. So, you know, I have no problem with that. I have no problem with cutting ties with Weiss, and no problem with bringing Richards in on a one-year basis. And so guys like Larkin, and other, by the way, it's not just Larkin. There's other guys that are high-end too. That farm system is mm-hmm. bountiful right now. So they've got some kids that can. The only question mark is you don't know how good the current kids are going to be, the Nyquists and the Tatars and guys like that. We don't know, Shea, we don't know really what their ceiling is. We know that they're NHL players, but we don't know yet how much better they can be.
Yeah. Yeah, and for that matter, the other question mark is still Jeff Blashill. We just don't know his ceiling either as well. But you kind of have to hope that the meshing of the oncoming youth with a coach who was very familiar with them, having coached them in the minors at Grand Rapids, adds up to a team that could go further in the playoffs. But let me ask you this before we move on with the Red Wings. Do you think, obviously, one of the rumors that would go around every year at free agency time when the Wings struggled to sign somebody was that players didn't want to play for Mike Babcock because he was, you know, not a player's coach. He was too tough. You know, he was scary, so to speak. And now with Jeff Blashill, who's really, in a lot of ways, we really don't know, other than his track record at Grand Rapids, but was very popular with his players from all accounts. Do you think that the change behind the bench may have played into the Wings finally getting some free agency action?
You know, that's been talked about. It's hard not to talk about that because it's so coincidental. I mean, it's so coincidental. And so naturally, people are going to be talking about that. These signings happened, you know, about a month after Babcock left for Toronto. Mm-hmm. So I understand it. I know why it's easy to make that assumption and say, well, not assumption, but that inference that has something. Obviously, we'll never really know unless somebody...
Right.
Says it. I mean, we won't know really until we'll see how Toronto does in terms of attracting free agents. I mean, mm-hmm. Who knows? And already they've rid themselves of Phil Kessel. They traded him to Pittsburgh. You know, it would have been kind of fascinating, I think, to see the Phil Kessel, Mike Babcock marriage, but that's not going to happen now. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much to buy into that whole notion. I don't know what's going through people's heads. I don't know I guess it depends, Al, on what they put a higher premium on. Do you put a higher premium on playing for a player's coach, or do you put a higher premium on winning? Yeah. You know, Scott, they used to say about Scotty Bowman, I think it was Bob Gainey, said for 364 days out of the year, you hate the guy, then on the 365th, he makes a Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. What do you put more premium on? You want to win, or you want to play for a warm and fuzzy guy who's going to be a quote-unquote player's coach? I have no idea. I guess it doesn't really matter. It's fun to think about, but unless somebody flat out comes out and whispers it to a reporter, well, you know, now that Babcock was gone, that's what made Detroit more attractive.
Right.
Unless you get that smoking gun, everything else is just going to be conjecture.
Yeah, and the other thing I would just add to that is, well, free agents want to go to places where they think they can win. And realistically, the Wings have not been serious cup contenders in, as you mentioned, 6 years. So now I think the window is slowly opening with this youth movement. And and I really do think that this is a team that in the next few years should be competing to at least reach conference finals. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I think that played into it as well. All right, Greg. The other team to make big news, who are trying to put together, as I use my metaphor, the Rubik's Cube of the roster, is the Pistons. Because since we last talked, there has been the NBA draft and also NBA free agency opened. So there was kind of a controversial first pick, just because it was interesting to watch the draft come fall out, in that it was expected the Pistons would likely have their choice and maybe one small forward, and that would be Stanley Johnson. But the way things fell at the number 8 pick, also along with Arizona's Johnson, Duke's Justice Winslow was also available, which I kind of threw a monkey wrench into things, just because they're different players in that I think Stanley Johnson might be more NBA ready body-wise right now. And he was essentially the number one guy on a team his freshman year. He's only a one-year guy. But there's a lot of people think that Justice Winslow has far more upside. You know, if you're looking for a guy to build a franchise around, he might end up being that guy, not Johnson. But when it went down, Van Gundy went with Johnson instead of Winslow. The pick seems to have been given a thumb down by most of the talking heads and experts, essentially saying Johnson has the intangibles, but he isn't a great shooter, and you need to be able to shoot to play for Stan Van Gundy, because how he likes that one-in, four-outside type offense, while Winslow, as I mentioned, is just believed to have far more upside and could be the better player down the line. So this is one of those things where I think it was, for whatever reason, we probably don't know why, the Pistons just had Johnson higher on the draft board.
Yeah, he was their guy. I mean, Stan Van Gundy just said, look, we had really no, inkling to go anywhere else. If Stanley Johnson was going to be there, we were going to pick him. I mean, period. Yeah. I mean, whether it was, pre-draft interviews or workouts or, who knows what was going on behind the scenes. I mean, for whatever reason, they liked Johnson and they picked him, and that's what you're supposed to do. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. Now, it seems like you always talk more about the people that you don't draft when it comes to the draft, and more than the people you do draft. And that's the nature of the beast. Fans are always going to want to talk about who you didn't draft, who was available, and so on and so forth. And sometimes that works out in your favor. Sometimes, we should have drafted the other guy. I get it. But this is not a Darko Milicic situation, by the way. I mean, it's not like this kid Johnson is taking a complete flyer and a risk and drafting this kid in a wing and a prayer. I mean, he's a player. He can play. He's got a lot of confidence. He's played in some big games in college. He played in some big games in high school. That helps. That does not hurt to have a kid that's been through whatever level of basketball he's played at. He's played at the highest level, and he's competed for championships. And you can't dismiss that. I think that's very important. I think that can sometimes be a deal breaker when you're choosing between one player or the other. I mean, a kid that's got, even at that tender age, has been through championship situations, whether it's in high school. I think he won like 3 or 4 championships in a row in high school in California, which is incredible. And then, of course, some big time games in college. So that's good. I mean, that's a good thing. Now, all we can do is just hope that they're right, that they picked the right guy. We're not going to know 2, 3, 4 years, until 2, 3, 4 years down the line. Right. But, there was no hesitation whatsoever to draft Johnson. If he was going to be there, even with Winslow available, again, it's always about who you don't draft. But, again, you can think back, Al. All I have to do is think back to 2009 with the Lions. All of us should draft that linebacker. Who was that linebacker everybody wanted in the draft instead of?
I know who you're talking about. I can't remember his name. I think
Aaron maybe something. Aaron. Oh, I don't know. Whoever they. We don't even know who he is. They wanted him to draft a linebacker. Was his last name Curry or something like that?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, they wanted to draft a linebacker with the first overall pick. That's crazy. Yeah. Oh, my gosh, should go defense. When you're 0-16, I don't know how you can look at an 0-16 team and say, that's the guy you got to pick. I mean, go for a franchise impact guy, and who can better impact your franchise than a quarterback? I don't think there's ever been a linebacker in the history of the NFL that's been drafted that has been a difference maker and if the face of the fan. I just don't think there's been one. So, and you can talk about the Pistons didn't draft the kid from Michigan. Who was the kid that could have drafted from Michigan that they didn't a couple years ago?
Oh, God. It's summer, Greg. I don't remember these things.
Well, you know, they could have drafted him. And, you know, the Lions in 1980, well, they could have drafted, should be Charles White or Billy Sims? Well, yeah. Charles White didn't have any sort of an NFL career whatsoever. Right. They picked the right guy there. It's always going to be up in these top 10 pick situations, they're always going to get after you for who you didn't draft. They're not going to talk so much about who you did. They want to talk about who you didn't. And that's just the way it is. So all you can do is just let this whole thing play out and just assume that they're right with their feelings and their scouting reports and their interviews and their gut feelings, and that they're right. That's all you can hope for, because, you know, if the Winslow kid turns out to be the greatest thing since sliced bread and Johnson kind of, but it also has to do with who you're drafted by. I mean, you know, basketball is so much about what team you're playing on, not so much about who you are. But, you know, sometimes it's not fair to compare the Pistons, for example, to another team that maybe has a different culture, different roster, different coach. There's a lot of different things that go into. It's not just an apples-to-apples comparison. You know, you can take a kid and put him in an NBA situation and then take the same kid and put him in another one, and it would be different because there's two different, you know, systems and coaches and cultures, and, you know, there's so many different and teammates, and it, you just can't say, well, if Pistons would have drafted this guy, they'd be a whole lot better than if they drafted this guy. You just can't say that.
Right, right. Yeah, it's and again, we're talking about 19-year-olds.
Right,
you know,
right.
And it's really a crapshoot at this point, because you're really just drafting on potential and upside and body type and a little bit of how at the level they play. But both these guys have played at the highest level and played very important games at big time programs. So
right.
You know, this is just one of those things where Van Gundy, and you just have to go. You have to go with Van Gundy and his staff, and then their feeling was Johnson fits our system better than Winslow. We think he is going to be the guy at small forward. Not right away, obviously, because we'll get into that, because he's not expected to be a starter or an impact player his first year. But again, this is one of those things. We see this in the NBA draft all the time. Guys are taking the lottery, and it's all about the future. You don't know, and when you're talking about guys projecting we're going to be 2, 3, 4 years down the line, who the hell knows? So I'm just going to go Van Gundy with this. If he thinks Johnson's the better pick, let's see what happens. And you made a great point. When you talk about the draft, you always end up talking about who they didn't get, like the big fish that got away. So right now it's Johnson, and they needed a small forward badly, and they got arguably one of the top two in the draft. So you can't argue about that. So, all right. But speaking, as I mentioned, that they needed a starter because they don't think Johnson's going to be ready to play big minutes, I guess, as a rookie. Van Gundy said going into free agency this week, and he had two prime targets at small forward and two secondary. Unfortunately, he didn't get a sniff from any of the big names at small forward, including Danny Green, LaMarcus Aldridge, and DeMarre Carroll. So that left either you go for rookie at small forward, and which they didn't want to do, or you have to make a trade. So this, in a lot of ways, Greg, was a steal, because the Suns wanted camp room to try and sign Aldridge. And to do so, the Pistons essentially said, look in our trash can, see what you find. And they got a 2020 second-round draft pick for three players, small forward Marcus Morris, small forward Danny Granger, and a swingman, Reggie Bullock, a small forward shooting guard type. Morris is expected to become the starter at the three, which will allow the Pistons to kind of mainstream Johnson in slowly.
If
he puts up 14-6, I think that's you're going to get a decent season out of the guy. That's the kind of guy he is. He's not an all-star, but he is a decent NBA quality player who will give you good minutes at a position of importance. And if Johnson is able to step up his game, you have a good depth guy. You got a solid backup because he's under contract for three more years at a relatively reasonable deal. Danny Granger is the name in this deal, but this isn't the Danny Granger you remember from the Pacers, an all-star type player. He's in his early 30s now. He's been battling injuries. It really looks like he may end up being released by the Pistons. And Bullock is going to be allowed to fight for a job in training camp. This is one of those deals where it was really a no-brainer for Van Gundy. A second round pick 5 years from now for three players. One guy's going to be a starter and he's young and under contract for 3 years. Where do I sign up for this deal? Let alone the fact that the Suns didn't get the player they wanted, even though they cleared all this cap space. So it really worked out well for the Pistons. Was Morris going to be light things up? No, but Morris is a solid player. And he fits a position in need. This is a great trade, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's a good trade. Right, it's a good trade from a roster standpoint. It's a good trade from a need standpoint. It's a good trade for, you know, a piece to the puzzle. But yeah. The Pistons, Al, still lack, and they've lacked for so many years. They still, and I know that these guys just don't grow on trees. I get it, but they still don't have that guy that's really the face of the franchise. You could talk about Andre Drummond. You know, obviously Greg Monroe left. He signed with Milwaukee. You know, they haven't had, and I know part of that is because they've been so bad for so many years that it's hard to have a face of a franchise when you're never in the playoffs. But they still don't have, I don't think, that clear option late in games when you have to make a shot. You have to have a big play made. They still lack, I think, that guy that you're really gonna. Now I know Reggie Jackson wants to be the general, and he wants to be the leader. And I know Drummond is working on his game, and he wants to be. You know, he's got a high ceiling. I understand that, but they don't have still don't have that guy where when the shot clock is ticking down, or if the game clock is ticking down, that's the guy that you desire to play for. They don't have that right now. I mean, there's a lot of guys who could potentially take a shot at the end of the game or do something, but they don't have a go-to guy that the other team's game plan for. There's just a bunch of still a bunch of, ragamuffin guys trying to put a team together, and I know that's been difficult to do when you've been so bad. That's why it's so hard to be bad for this long in the NBA and to try to turn it around unless you get the number one overall pick or the number two overall pick or somebody that can come in and be a difference maker right away. It's hard even at number eight, where the Pistons drafted this year, to really get a guy that's going to be, you're going to make him the guy. And so right now they're just, since they don't have that, they're just trying to put these pieces of the puzzle together, try to build a more Sand and Gunny-like roster, and maybe somebody will emerge, and maybe this collection of people can gel. But there's still not, to me, anybody in the roster where you say, okay, well, we're in trouble, that's who we go to. Now, that could be good or it could be bad. I mean, maybe it's good to not have just the one guy, but it seems like in the NBA that most teams that are successful have at least one player who kind of takes over in those situations, and the Pistons just don't have that right now. And so until they get one, it's just going to have to be every man on deck and hope that these pieces that Van Gundy is putting together can, be at least some sort of a knockoff version of the Magic teams he had in Orlando.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you mentioned, this team is a work in progress, and hopefully there could be guys, as you said, there could be guys on this roster right now who could turn into that late game force, be it Reggie Jackson, be it Andre Drummond, be it Stanley Johnson for that matter.
Or Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, he kind of flies under the radar a little bit. I think Pistons fans should be pretty high on him. I think he's got, to me, he's got the makeup. He's got the moxie. I think he's the kind of guy that could be that guy that takes that shot as the clock is winding down. But until he does it, obviously, you don't know. And there's really been nobody on that roster that's really done it in any particular, certainly in any high leverage situation.
Yeah. And speaking of a player who really realistically in this last year turned into, one of out of position on this Pistons team, as Greg Monroe, ever since signing that turning down a long-term contract last year and going with the inexpensive qualifying offer to become a free agent this year. Well, that move paid off for Greg Monroe, as he, as expected, moved on from the Pistons and signed a max deal with the Milwaukee Bucks, who really look like a very intriguing team now. That looks like a team that could really make a move in the East this year. He went for the Bucks for 3 years, $50 million. Greg Monroe really seems to be playing his free agency game really well. It wasn't a long-term contract, so he will still be in his prime after the salary cap explodes in a couple years. And he's gonna get another big long-term contract. Is he a max player? Probably not. But a team like Milwaukee definitely has to overpay to get a top-tier free agent. And, you know, more power to Greg Monroe. I think he is a great fit with Milwaukee, and he was no longer a good fit with the Pistons because of the Van Gundy offense, as we saw at the end of last year when Monroe was hurt, and the Pistons went on a tear because, it's always a cliche to say a player clogs up the offense or clogs up the bases or he's too much of a plotter. But in this case, with Monroe and the Pistons and the offense they wanted to run, he just didn't seem to be a good fit anymore because Van Gundy is the four-out, one-in kind of guy. Monroe was not an outside player. He's an inside plotter. He needed to find a better fit. He looks like he has found a much better fit in the long run, and this may end up being working out well for both teams. As the Pistons have already replaced him, and for that matter, it allowed them to. It gives them more cap space in the long run. So I hate to see him go, but I really don't think he fits this team anymore.
No, I agree. You know, by the way, we neglected to talk about the trade they made with the guy that he could be a key cog as well. But yeah. You know, I agree with you about Monroe. You know, it just wasn't. Sometimes it just doesn't work out, and it's nobody's fault. You know, I think Greg's a good player. You know, it's just not a good fit, especially with the new regime. And you know, I think the Pistons probably would have. Maybe they're probably not all that sad right now. I mean, if they could have re-signed him, I think for the sake again of loyalty and try to keep that guy a Piston for a long time, and maybe try to work build around him or help build, you know, not around him necessarily, but have him be part of a new winning culture. I think would have been cool. But I think from a pure basketball sense, taking all the emotions out of it, making more of a black and white situation. I think that it just was time for him to try somewhere else. And good for him. You know, I don't wish him any ill will at all. I hope he does well with Milwaukee. I hope he's reunited with Brandon Knight now. And so who knows? I mean, we'll see if Monroe's going to be one of these guys that you would see in an NBA final down the line, or if he's just another one of these players that just kind of has a nice career and never really has a lot of playoff experience, kind of like an Ernie Banks kind of player. Just, you know, he just never really gets a lot of postseason. Who knows? We'll see. But you're right. I think it was not a good fit. The writing was on the wall. The Pistons obviously had moved on when they made the trade with Milwaukee, and you know, they pretty much shut the door on Monroe returning. And you know, that's the way it is at the NBA. It's a business like it is in all sports. And it's nobody's fault. It's not Greg Monroe's fault. It's not Sam Van Gundy's fault. You know, he's a new guy coming in with a new system. He wants to do things a certain way. He's got certain players he thinks are good fits for that. And I don't think he really felt like. And you mentioned earlier about, you know, Greg Monroe snubbing the Pistons last summer and just choosing instead to go for the qualifying offer, which obviously was the biggest, probably the most prevalent writing on the wall. And everything else after that was pretty much kind of put him in a lame duck situation. But, you know, they gave it a year with him, with the new regime, and obviously nothing clicked enough to make either side really go out of their way to try to make that happen. I don't think anybody, either of them really wanted to really kind of go out of their comfort zone to make that work. So I think that was just kind of a professional, courteous way of saying, you know, we're not meant for each other and let's go our separate ways. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. That happens all the time. It's professional. It's not personal. I'm sure that there was not a personal thing between Greg Monroe and Sam Van Gundy. I think that's a realization that You know, it's just, hey, Greg had been there for 5 years, and let's face it, nothing happened. Nothing happened whatsoever. He played for a bunch of coaches. You know, all he knew was losing 50 games a year. I mean, that wears on you as well. Sometimes if you're in a Greg Monroe situation, you may just want to get out just to get out. But sometimes you just want to say, you know what, this situation in Milwaukee isn't necessarily my dream situation per se. You know, they may have an upside that I like, but sometimes it's just, I want to get out of a place that's lost 50 games a year. I mean, the Bucks haven't been much either lately, but sometimes you get to the point, Al, where you literally want change for the sake of change.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you said, relationships in pro sports just run their course. And this is one that has. And the player you're talking about is, in a way, you could just say the Pistons traded to the Bucks Greg Monroe for Ersan Ilyasova,
right,
who is a true stretch four.
Right.
And a much better fit for the type of offense Van Gundy wants to run, because Ilyasova can pop from outside. And he has a more reasonable contract. It's only for 2 more years and can be bought out after another year. So Ilyasova's deal gives the Pistons a lot more flexibility, and they may become a more of a free agent destination if they can make the playoffs. And I think they are more set to be get that 7th or 8th seed in the East, with Ilyasova playing the majority of minutes at power forward and Greg Monroe, just because of the type of offense Van Gundy runs. And that's what it all comes down to, Greg. It just comes down to Stan Van Gundy and the team he wants to have, and he wants it in his mold, and Greg Monroe just didn't fit the mold. That's just how it works out sometimes.
Yep.
All right, let's wrap this up. As Greg, I think, has shish kebabs to make, so that means it's time for Jerk of the Week. Who's your jerk?
You know, these Pittsburgh Pirates, Al, you know, we saw them in Detroit last week, and they swept the Tigers. But, you know, they've got this reputation of taking all these hit batsmen that they get personally and retaliating all the time. Now, Justin Verlander hit Marte last week on a 1-2 pitch that I think clearly got away from Justin. You know, I don't know why you hit a guy when you're ahead in the count 1-2. You're trying to get him out at that point.
Yeah.
And the pitch got away and hit him in the arm or whatever. Okay, fine. And sure enough, Gerrit Cole, who is as good as it comes when it comes to control and knowing where he wants to put the ball, sure enough, you know, very next inning, plunks Victor Martinez in the back with a very clear, it was, a clear purpose pitch. There was nothing, it didn't get away from him. It was completely on purpose. And the Pirates will tell you, as they've told everybody all year, that this is the way we do things. It's an eye for an eye. And, you know, you pitch inside our guys, we're going to pitch inside of here, whatever. I mean, I'm tired of it. I'm tired of every hit batsman turning into, this is not just the Pirates, by the way, although I think they're some of the biggest violators. I'm sick of every hit batsman turning into a retaliation situation. I mean, nobody's thinking about what the situation was when that guy got hit. You know, and nobody's showing any reason. It's that judge, jury, executioner. Okay, well, if you hit one of our guys, we're going to hit one of your guys no matter what. You know, and that's not the way the days of yore, when an eye for the eye for an eye thing was happening, that was teams knew when guys were getting hit on purpose. I mean, and not only did the teams know, the players knew. Now Marte should have said when he got back to the dugout, don't escalate this. I can tell when I've been hit on purpose and when I've been hit by a breaking ball that didn't break. Which is what happened in the Verlander situation. He doesn't have to. He can tell, and I've heard other players say that. Mm-hmm. Ron Allen said it as well. As a hitter, you know. He says it's hard for me to describe, but you know when you've been hit on purpose. Now Victor Martinez was hit on purpose. I clearly believe that. I don't blame Victor for getting upset. But these Pirates have to relax, and everybody around baseball has got to relax with this retaliation thing. I mean, not every hit batsman. It requires retaliation. And I just think we're getting too far into this. Oh, you hit one of our guys, we're going to hit one of your guys. And I just think it's just too much. So my jerk of the week is really the Pirates, but it's kind of this whole mentality of eye for the eye, eye for an eye.
Yeah, it's the old unwritten rules of baseball, and I hate them, pure and simple. And this is one of them. So good call on that. I'm going to go a little out of the box on my Jerk of the Week. It's something that shows up on ESPN every 4th of July. Obviously, that was yesterday as we were recording. And, well, first off, let me start. For those of you too young to remember, weren't around back in the day of the early days of cable television, ESPN actually stands for Entertainment and Sports Programming Network. Mm-hmm. Well, on 4th of July every year, they show on a sports network, which is what ESPN has become, a freak show. And that is the hot dog eating contest at Coney Island, Nathan's hot dog eating contest. And this, you know, this one of those things that just kind of rubs me the wrong way. One, because it's gross as hell to watch. I can't even fathom shoving hot dogs in my mouth, and the quickest way to eat them in this contest is to dunk the buns in water and shove a water-soaked hot dog bun in your mouth. Ah! It just sounds gross to think about, let alone... It was a big deal, at least in a way, on a slow news day, because the 8-time defending champion Joey Chestnut lost to Matt Stoney, 62 hot dogs to 60. But it's a sideshow, it's a freak show, and it also, you know, call me politically correct, you know, as I am a raging liberal anyway. But you know, people are starving in this world, and yet we have contests like this, which is essentially just throwing away food. That's always been one of my pet peeves. You know, because I've had issues in the past where money became an issue because of my health. And, you know, you have to make it, sometimes you got to make a pick for your bills. Do I pay bills or do I eat? And then to see something like this where it seems like a huge waste of time, money, effort, and food. And that just rubs me the wrong way. So my Jerk of the Week is ESPN. For they're making the Nathan's Coney Island hot dog eating contest into this national thing that people pay attention to, when it really belongs, I know, as the freak show part of, on a boardwalk somewhere.
Good call. I disagree with anything you just said. It's American excess at its worst, and you know, it's like these restaurants now that that serve these huge portions, and they're so proud of that, and half of it gets thrown out anyway. I agree with you about the hot dog eating thing. I think not only is it gross and disgusting, but it's just not necessary. But you know, it is, that's America for you. What can I say?
Yeah, America, go America.
Yeah. Yes. I want to remind everybody, we'll be back with you 2 weeks from today, July 19th. 4 weeks from today, August the 2nd, we'll be joined by Oakland University basketball coach Greg Campy. We're really looking forward to that interview. So tune in then as well for sure. Follow us on Twitter, at The Knee Jerks, and also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheKneeJerks, and our blog, TheKneeJerks.us. Follow me on Twitter, at Greg Eno, and GregEno.com for my internet bleedings, and from my Tiger stuff, go to DetroitTigers.about.com and read me twice a week there. So with that, I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon, and thank you, Big Al, for making Sunday afternoon so gosh darn fun.
Yes, people, make sure to bookmark DetroitTigers.about.com for all your Greg Eno goodness, which I have it bookmarked. I'm not lying. So
I know you got it.
All right. And as always, I want to thank you, Greg, for taking time out of your busy holiday this week to talk some sports. And with that, let's wrap it up. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. Until that time, this is Al Beaton saying good afternoon, good luck, and aloha.
Ciao, everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks.